Well, thank you for your welcome. Nice to be with you here this afternoon. And I'm going to try and be fairly brief in what I say. I hope some of you can stay on for questions. I always like to get that kind of a response as well. And this afternoon we're going to be thinking together about the person of Jesus, who Jesus is and how people have responded to him over history. Now, of course, Jesus is open to many misunderstandings. People misunderstand all sorts of things about Christianity. I want to start with something I find rather amusing. And it's just a story of a classic misunderstanding of Christianity. It comes from several years ago when a very well-to-do lady in London was planning a trip down to Cornwall. And she was going to be staying at a guest house that was run by a local farmer. And in those days, you couldn't be sure of whether you'd have an indoor toilet or not, because a lot of toilets were outside. So she wrote her letter to the farmer who was running the guest house, inquiring as to the location of the nearest WC. Now, of course, WC is posh language for a loo, water closet. But the farmer who received the letter had never seen that expression before, WC. He didn't know what she was asking for. So he went to speak to a local Catholic priest about it. And the priest looked at it and said, well, down here in Cornwall, we've got a lot of Wesleyan chapels. So I guess she's a religious lady looking for the location of the nearest Wesleyan chapel, Methodist chapel. This is the letter that he sent back to the lady. Dear madam, I take great pleasure in informing you that the WC is located 9 miles from the house. It is located in the middle of a grove of pine trees surrounded by lovely grounds. It has a capacity of 200 people and is open on Sundays and Thursdays. As there are many people expected in the summer months, I suggest you arrive early. This is an unfortunate situation, especially if you're in the habit of going frequently. There is, however, plenty of standing room. Actually, my daughter was married in the WC, as it was there that she met her husband. It was a wonderful event. There were 10 people to every seat. It was wonderful to see the expressions on their faces. My wife sadly has been ill and unable to go recently. It has been almost a year since she went last, which pains her greatly. You'll be pleased to know that many people bring lunch and make a day of it. Others prefer to wait till the last minute and arrive just in time. I would recommend that you go on a Thursday afternoon, as there is an organ accompaniment. The acoustics are excellent, and even the most delicate sounds can be heard by all. Yours, the guest house master. Well, misunderstandings plague the Christian world. And I mentioned something like the Bible this afternoon, or the New Testament, and indeed the person of Jesus, and there will be layer upon layer of misunderstanding. A history of accreations of myths or rumours or gossip or legend that get in the way of what we're really talking about. So for a lot of my time, I want to try and deal with some of those misconceptions. And to start with, one of the key objections to taking Jesus seriously, to considering his claims seriously, comes perhaps most notably in the writings and the speaking of Richard Dawkins, who particularly dismisses introducing Jesus into the debate as somehow a kind of petty argument. And what Richard Dawkins means by that is that if we're going to talk about the ultimate meaning of life or a basis for how we're going to live our lives, surely what we really want is some kind of universal law or some deep principle, something that is absolute, a principle that we can discover perhaps from the natural universe itself and apply to all time and space. And the problem the moment we mention Jesus is that we're talking about a particular man at a particular time and place. Sometimes it's called the scandal of particularity. How dare Christians introduce into these big debates over the meaning of life this very particular person who lived at a particular time and place? Well, that's where I want us to begin, with this scandal of particularity. And yet now, as we look back through history, through 2,000 years, we find that Jesus, for all the misunderstandings, has had an enormous impact. So many different people from different religions and philosophies and worldviews have recognised that there's something unique, something different about Jesus. They may disagree about some of the implications of his teaching, but there seems to be a pretty clear uniformity over the last 2,000 years that this man has incredible stature whether we're talking about morality or philosophy or the purpose of life. Mahatma Gandhi, who is the very influential Hindu Indian leader who led India to independence, Mahatma Gandhi was greatly influenced by the teachings of Jesus, the non-violence movement that Gandhi put into practice in their movement for independence in India. It was also followed up by Martin Luther King and the Black Civil Rights Movement. Gandhi attributes his influence as primarily the teachings of Jesus and the Sermon on the Mount. Gandhi, the Hindu leader, said this: "What then does Jesus mean to me? To me, he was one of the greatest teachers humanity ever had." Jesus was one of the greatest teachers humanity ever had. And that from a great Hindu leader. Among historians, no one can escape the influence and impact of Jesus. We know that our whole dating system has been driven down the middle by the birth of Jesus. We still, in old-fashioned circles, talk about BC and AD, dating from before Christ to Anno Domini. Of course, if you're more up-to-date, you won't use that language anymore. It's BCE and CE. But that's only a change of language. Before the Common Era and CE Common Era still refers to the birthday of Jesus Christ. No wonder historians have noted this significance. H.G. Wells, who was not only a science fiction writer but also a significant historian himself, H.G. Wells made this comment: "I'm a historian, I'm not a believer, I'm an atheist, but I must confess as a historian that this penniless preacher from Nazareth is the very centre of history. Jesus Christ is easily the most dominant figure in all history." An atheist secular historian looking back through the pages of history cannot escape the impact of this man, this penniless preacher from Nazareth. Napoleon, the military leader, commenting on Jesus as he surveys various historical figures who had an influence, Napoleon said, "I know men, and I know that this was no mere man. I know men, and I know that this was no mere man." Outside of the world of history and philosophy, we could think about the influence on creative geniuses. I went up to the Van Gogh exhibition of letters in London a couple of weeks ago, and as you walk through the corridors, if you go into that kind of exhibition, you make the mistake usually of taking too long over the early bits because you think you're going to have time to see everything, and then you find that you spend a lot of time looking at the early bits, which actually aren't that good, as Van Gogh is learning. But then you're running out of time and starting to feel hungry and want to get a pizza, and you come into the final room where you're seeing before you some of those beautiful pictures of the cypress trees and the sunshine, the incredible oils and colours that Van Gogh was experimenting in. And if you know Van Gogh's biography, his background, again, we come to this incredible influence of Jesus. Van Gogh wrote this in one of his letters: "Jesus lives serenely as a greater artist than all other artists, despising marble and clay as well as colour, working in living flesh. That is to say, this matchless artist made neither statues nor pictures nor books, but he made living men into immortals." Jesus left behind no book that he'd written himself, no statue and no painting. And yet, we can't do any art history over the last 2,000 years and avoid his incredible impact in areas of literature, fine art, and sculpture. Turning to the 20th century, let's describe him as the honest agnostic Albert Einstein, great, brilliant genius of the 20th century. Einstein, Jewish in background, said this about Jesus: "No man can deny the fact that Jesus existed, nor that his sayings are beautiful. No man can read the Gospels without feeling the actual presence of Jesus. His personality pulsates in every word. I'm a Jew, but I'm enthralled by the luminous figure of the Nazarene, And what I note particularly in those words of Einstein is that somehow when we begin to read the words of Jesus, not penned by him, but penned by the eyewitnesses, we seem to encounter more than just literature. In fact, it's been noted that the Gospels, the four biographies that we have of the life of Jesus, are not in themselves great literature. They're written in a very common form of Greek, a very casual form of Greek, more the Greek of the marketplace than the Greek of fine literature. And so what we meet with in the New Testament doesn't seem to be an example of the greatest literature ever written, and yet the words that Jesus spoke seem to still speak with a living voice that continues to stop people in their tracks and to change lives. This is particularly evident in another little quote I want to share with you. When one day John Cleese and Michael Palin, the Monty Python team, decided it would be a great idea to make a film called The Life of Jesus. And it would be just a great parody film to put together a life of this misunderstood penniless preacher from Nazareth. So they went away for a weekend, the two of the Monty Python team, with nothing but the New Testament. And their plan was just to read the Gospels through and write out the rough workings for this script of a film that would be called The Life of Jesus. And they found at the end of that weekend that they just couldn't do it. They could not bring themselves to write the film they had in mind. They wrote instead the script for the film you may have seen, The Life of Brian, which is a kind of film of a parallel character going through similar situations. But John Cleese later commented on why they couldn't bring themselves to write The Life of Jesus instead of The Life of Brian. These are John Cleese's words. "The moment you got really near the figure of Christ, it just wasn't really funny. Because Christ was wise and flexible and intelligent, and he didn't have any of the things that comedy is about. Envy, greed, malice, avarice, lust, stupidity. In reading the Gospels, they were confronted by somebody that just didn't fit into the picture of what they wanted to write a comedy about." Actually, it does tell you something about John Cleese's view of comedy as well, but that's for another talk maybe. In reading the words of Jesus directly, we're confronted by somebody that doesn't meet our expectations. I was brought up going to church as a young boy, and my dad, who along with my mum, would drag me along week after week, though I found it a matter of infinite boredom. My dad was a church warden in the church, and also an atheist. And I always found that kind of a bit of an anomaly when I was growing up. But the debates I had about whether God existed or not was with the church warden, who was also my dad. But that kind of was all of a piece with the kind of church that I went to, where belief in God was kind of optional, as long as you said the right words and did the right things. And being brought up in that kind of background, I guess I kind of thought that I knew what Jesus was all about. I heard the name Christ Sunday after Sunday. And it didn't mean anything to me. It was all a matter of very debatable history. Then when I was about the age, I guess, as the teenage years went by, I dropped off going to church. I was no longer draggable, so I didn't go along anymore. But at around the age of 17, when I was at sixth form college, some of my friends had formed a Christian union, which I thought was pretty odd. I thought, why does somebody want to call themselves a Christian and spend a lunchtime going to a Christian union? But one of them invited me along, and they were friends, and I knew that there was something about them that I didn't have. There was something different about them. For all of the things that I'd seen in going to church week after week, there was a gap in my understanding of religion. And so I went along to one of their meetings, and it was at that meeting that a journey began for me. It lasted a couple of months, of coming to read the Gospels with an open mind for the first time in my life. And I began to read these words of Jesus with an open mind. And I discovered not an ancient, ambiguous voice, but a living voice speaking to me in the here and now. It was as if Jesus just walked off those pages I was reading. And this was no longer a debate about history. It was a living voice of somebody that I was encountering here and now. It was at that time that I became a Christian, that I had to just pray to God to forgive me for what I'd done wrong, and I asked him to come and live in my life, And Jesus for me became a reality that he'd never been before in all of that church going. Some of the words I remember reading that were particularly striking. Jesus saying this in the Gospel of John, "I am the way, the truth and the life. No one comes to the Father but by me." And I remember thinking to myself, how can people admire somebody so much who'd said something that's so arrogant? I mean, we talk about someone being a good teacher or a moral person, and generally we mean they're very humble, very self-effacing. But here is someone claiming that if we want to know God, it will have to be through them, on their terms. How could just a good teacher be saying something so extraordinarily arrogant if it isn't true? And then on another occasion, a remarkable story of Jesus, when some friends of a paralyzed man brought the paralyzed victim to the feet of Jesus. In fact, to get him to Jesus, because the crowd had formed, they had to cut a hole in the roof and lower their paralyzed friend on a mat down in front of Jesus. And what's really striking in the story is that as Jesus obviously stops speaking with all of the clatter falling down from the ceiling, and as this body of the paralyzed man lies before him, Jesus asks, "What do you want me to do for you?" And I remember thinking to myself, it's pretty obvious what they want you to do, Jesus, is heal the man. He's paralyzed. He needs healing. "What do you want me to do for you?" asked Jesus. Isn't the answer obvious? And Jesus says to this paralyzed man, "Son, your sins are forgiven." In other words, the first thing Jesus does is not to heal the man, it's to forgive the man. The first thing he does isn't to do anything about his physical body on the outside, it's to do something for a heart problem he has on the inside. And the reaction to that of the people standing around was not to say, "Wow, this is a good moral teacher." The reaction to the people around was not to say, "What a fine man this Jesus is." Instead, they said, "Why does this fellow talk like that? He's blaspheming. Who can forgive sins but God alone?" Jesus had changed not immediately the man's body, he'd go on to do that, but the man's heart. He brought him forgiveness. And this is what would trigger a mounting campaign to get Jesus crucified. A rising, seething sea of hostility to Jesus that would lead to his death, to his crucifixion. The cross is the part of the story of Jesus that the biographies, the Gospels of Jesus, dwell most upon. All of them describe the life of Jesus as heading for this appointment with death, with the cross. All of them dwell upon what would happen on that in that grisly time of his trial, his beating, whipping, crucifixion. All of them dwell on this part of the story, the death of Jesus. And yet in many ways that's an odd thing. Because if we wanted to say Jesus was a great moral teacher, why is so much emphasis placed on his death? And particularly the way he died. Now of course for us, we I guess are fairly familiar with images of crosses in church buildings and in ornate public buildings we might visit. The image of the cross can be fairly ornate. But in ancient times of course, we know the cross was one of the most grisly forms of Roman torture equipment ever developed. And the earliest actual picture of the cross of Jesus was not found in some cathedral or church building. The earliest painting or picture of the crucifixion of Jesus was discovered not that many years ago in a school just outside of Rome. It was a 2nd century school for page boys that was being excavated by archaeologists. And this image of the cross of Jesus, as I say, 2nd century AD, this image of the cross of Jesus was actually a graffiti. It was a graffiti that some school boys had painted onto the plaster, or scratched onto the plaster, I should say. And it showed another one of the children in the school, another boy in the school, called Alexamenos. And Alexamenos stands with one hand in the air. And by the side of Alexamenos, there's the image of the cross. And on the cross is a naked body with the head of a donkey. And scratched beneath it is the inscription, "Alexamenos worships his God." Now what clearly happened is in a pagan Roman school, Here was one Christian who was no doubt ridiculed for his faith and mocked for what he believed, and other children, I guess, had scratched this up on the wall, and then I guess maybe it never, the staff had never even bothered to have it removed or covered up, but it got covered up in the debris of time to be revealed by archaeologists nearly 2,000 years later. And it's an insight into what the cross is really all about. Because the cross, primarily, it's not a beautiful gold ornament. It was something that humiliated the person crucified. It was a barbaric, terrible death. And it would have spoken volumes at the time of failure and of defeat. And yet Christians, right from the beginning, chose the cross as their symbol, because they believed that here was not failure, but victory. Because Jesus rose again from the dead, the story of the cross would not be the end of the story. Jesus came back to life again, showing that death had been defeated, showing that when he said he could forgive sin, or forgive the bad things we do, he really meant it. And in finding forgiveness, we can find new life. When I became a Christian, having come to believe in Jesus myself, it was at that time that I also got my first car. Now, my first car that I got, so I was 17, I passed my test of my first time round, and I didn't have much money, so I had to get a car pretty quickly, and my first car cost me £80. And it's not that I'm really, really old, and £80 was a lot of money in those days. £80 was not a lot of money to spend on a car. But I bought myself a Triumph Toledo. You may not have heard of those. They were nearly all produced in brown. And mine was a classic brown Triumph Toledo for £80. And it was fine for the first few days, but then the problems began to emerge. It had problems with rust all around the wheel arches. The rust was just getting worse and worse. I think whoever I bought it from had kind of managed to cover it up quite well. But within weeks, the rust was getting pretty bad around the wheel arches. It had a problem with the exhaust being very, very smoky, producing a lot of smoke as I drove around. And the other embarrassing problem is when I'd park at a friend's house and then drive away, it would leave a pool of oil behind on the ground. So I had to be careful whose friend's house I parked outside of. Well, I went one day into a shop called Halfords, and I thought I'd found the answer, because, you see, Halfords, I discovered, sold things that were the answers to all my problems. I found in Halfords that they had this pot of something called engine stop leak. And it said, if you pour it into the engine, it will seal up all the leaks. You'll no longer have oil anymore pouring out of the bottom of your engine. And I also found this paint. They still sell it to this day. This paint, it is anti-rust paint. So the bottle said, if I paint it onto the rusty old wheel arches of my car, the rust will turn back to metal. So I bought these, along with a few other bits and bobs, to stick in the car and make it like new, I thought. And I discovered that actually the problems only got worse. The problem actually with pouring in this engine stop leak is it works. It does seal up the oil leaks for a while. But if it was blowing smoke before, it was blowing smoke an awful lot worse after I put it in. Somehow the oil had to get out somewhere, I guess. And so I was now blowing out all of the smoke wherever I went. And worse still, that paint works. But it's not good news. Because what happened is, I painted it on, and this rusty metal turned into this thick, black, heavy substance that was then so heavy, it just fell out the car, leaving a hole behind where the rust had been before. You see, what I was discovering at the time when I became a Christian is that my car was past it. My car needed a complete overhaul. The 120,000 miles it had done meant that the car itself was past a patch-up job. And in my life, I found that religion was only offering a patch-up job. All the answers that the world's great leaders and philosophers offer can only be a patch-up job for the problem we really have. You see, Jesus said that our greatest problem is not that we need to know how to live. Our greatest problem is we need to know forgiveness. And that's why he came to die on the cross. Not to provide us with a patch-up job for our problems, but to provide us with a transformation, a complete overhaul. He died on the cross to take the punishment that you and I deserve, so that he really can say, I forgive you. You are forgiven. And if you put your trust in me, you can know that new life, which starts now and goes on even beyond the grave. Well, I just want to finish. Thank you for listening so well. I just want to finish with two other quotes, and then you can get some more to eat. I'd love to discuss more with you if you've got questions. But two more quotes. The first one is a very famous quote, which I can't resist using as I'm in Oxford, which for many Christians is particularly renowned as the place where C.S. Lewis taught for so many years. And C.S. Lewis made that so striking quote on the thing that we've been thinking about this lunchtime. Lewis, who himself became a Christian having been an atheist, said, "We're faced then with a frightening alternative. This man we're talking about was and is just what he said, or else a lunatic, or something worse. Now it seems to me obvious that Jesus was neither a lunatic or a fiend, and consequently, however strange or terrifying or unlikely it may seem, I have to accept the view that he was and is God." Lewis there was drawing attention to the fact we don't have the option that Mahatma Gandhi tried to take of describing Jesus as just a great moral teacher. At the heart of his teachings was pointing to himself as the Saviour. We don't have the option of describing him as just a great moral teacher. He either is God who's come to save us, or he's a liar or a lunatic. Well, my final quote for you as I finish is from James Irwin. James Irwin, one of the Apollo astronauts, when he came back to Earth, was asked about some of his experiences in space, and often took those as opportunities to share his faith in God. And one day he said this in an interview on TV, when they asked him about his experience of actually walking on the moon, being one of the very few people to walk on the surface of another body in space. Irwin said, "Do you know the most significant achievement of our age is not that man stood on the moon, but rather that God in Christ stood upon this earth." If what we've been saying this afternoon is true, then surely he's right. This is the most significant thing we're ever going to hear. Thank you. I'll finish there. Thank you very much. Great, okay, so it's a question. I'll just repeat the question. Don't forget a question wrong, but the paraphrase question. What about all those people who lived before Jesus? I mean, you know, we can be talking about millions upon millions of people who lived before Jesus. So, if this all comes down to what Jesus says, then is it that it only kicks into relevance from his time onwards? Or does it kind of apply backwards? That's the kind of question, isn't it? So, yeah, great question. I mean, first of all, just to back up slightly, this point about the scandal of particularity is to say that for many people, they would prefer to have maybe a Christian philosophy that was based on some moral principles that applied to all time and place than getting into this nitty-gritty of historical events. And for reasons like this, that then you've got a moral philosophy that applies to all time and all places. But what we read in the Bible is that that's not what God is like. God actually stepped into history because history really matters. And if God is going to identify with us, if he's going to identify with you, he's going to have to do it as a person. And if he's going to do it as a person, it's got to be in a particular time and place. And he couldn't be a real person and sort of always be around, walking around, you know, right from the sort of monkey times to present times, walking about as a person. But the problem with that is it wouldn't be a real person. People are born, they grow up, they struggle, they die. So Jesus goes through and identifies with us. So if God is going to identify with us, it's going to have to be in some time and place. You could say, well, why wasn't it a few thousand years earlier? But then, of course, that question is a difficult one to answer, because you'd always be able to go back a bit further and say, well, why not earlier still? Why not earlier still? Why that point in time? And the only answer to that I would say is that if it's going to be at a particular time and place, well, one time's as good as another. I mean, I would give reasons as to why it was then, but in a sense, that's not really the point. It's going to have to be at a particular time and place. So that's the sort of backup. Now to go to your question, which is there, then, what do we say about those who lived before Jesus? How does this affect them? Well, I would say that what Jesus came to bring in terms of salvation, in terms of changing our lives, he achieved through dying on the cross. But that achievement is relevant to all people and all places and all times, even if they don't know it directly. So it's not that the person who's never heard about Jesus is automatically a Christian without them even knowing about it. I'm not saying that for one moment. But I am saying that the honest person who realises that they've got something wrong with themselves, they cast themselves on the mercy of a creator God who they don't directly know, but they believe intuitively is out there, that they believe they've done wrong and they need forgiveness. Well, that's what they were doing in the Old Testament, in effect, which is our book before Jesus. The sincere person who casts themselves on God's mercy in that setting, well, Jesus died for them. So it applies backwards as well as forwards. So that's how I would deal with that issue. Does that answer your question? Is that getting along the lines of your question?
It does, but it's also worrying. Because I know lots of good people who don't think they need forgiveness because they've tried their best.
Yeah. Great. Well, okay, of course it's worrying. I mean, it's worrying because most of us, deep down, think we're doing our best. You know, most people you speak to think they're doing all right, or they're generally trying to be helpful people. And even in prison, that's true. You know, statistics show in prison that most people in prison feel that they are pretty good people. It's the others who aren't. And so most of us think we're doing our best. And Jesus said, look, be honest here. Well, this is paraphrasing Jesus. Look, be honest here. Before God, who is perfect and holy, none of us are perfect and holy. All of us are guilty. Jesus put it so radically, this is what influenced Gandhi, the Sermon on the Mount. He said, look, you worry about laws that say don't murder. All right, most of you here can probably say you haven't murdered anybody today. You know, you can get away with that one. Jesus said, look, but the principle of the law is much stronger than that. The principle of the law is that you shouldn't be angry with other people. You shouldn't have malicious thoughts about other people. And once we get onto the Jesus track, we find actually we're not doing our best at all. I mean, we are falling way short of these standards. Now, I believe, as we look at people who've never heard of Jesus, there are probably many who've actually realised that. They've probably thought to themselves, actually, I'm not good enough for God. I need forgiveness. I need rescue. We find them in the Old Testament. You know, in the Old Testament, the oldest book of all in the Bible is the book of Job, older than the book of Genesis even. And the book of Job, or Job if you want to pronounce it that way, describes somebody who wasn't an Israelite. So he wasn't, not only was he not a Christian, but he wasn't even a Jew, or an Israelite, or the Jews. So he was somebody outside of the fold completely. And this man, Job, he says, I know that my Redeemer lives. I know there's somebody who's going to redeem me, which really means save me. So there's somebody from outside of any of the kind of Israelite Christian people who recognises that it's not that he's perfect before God, but he knows that God is the one who's going to save him. So that gives me confidence. I appreciate what you're saying, which is that surely most people you meet don't think they need God. What's going to happen to them? Well, I'm not God, so I'm not, you know, in a position to say. But what I do know from what Jesus said is that every one of us needs this forgiveness, needs what he's brought us. And that's the real crunch, you know, is that every one of us needs to come to him. Yeah, I mean, do we...
Yes.
I mean, I don't mind if others don't mind. Yeah, do you just want to come back on that one then? And second question? Yeah. Yeah, I mean, okay, so what about those who are brought up as Hindus or Muslim and have never heard anything of perhaps the kind of Christian teachings that I'm sharing with you? What about them? With all these kinds of questions, I think I just have to honestly say that I believe God deals with people individually. I'm not God. I'm not in a position to be able to talk about individuals. What I do know is that God has provided the medicine that we need and what Jesus has done. I do know that only through Jesus can people know this. But I'm not in a position to say how much does somebody who's never heard about these things need to know to be able to throw themselves at God's mercy. I just trust that God knows what he's doing. I trust that God will do the right thing. And, you know, I couldn't dare comment on somebody I've never heard about. You know, that it's the kind of situation we might imagine of somebody who's never heard any of these things, living perhaps in far out somewhere in Mongolia, and they've never come across these things. What do they do with the little knowledge they have? Well, all I can say is that I trust that God has provided them with what they need to know. If they truly believe that they need this rescue and forgiveness and throw themselves in God's mercy, well, I trust God to do the right thing. So, you know, that's as much as I can say, I think, in answer to a question like that. Because it's a very profound question. Christians have been discussing that one for 2,000 years, and there's lots, you know, that they've said about it. It's a profound question. Yeah, should we... Taking off. Anybody else want to come out? Maybe a different pitch? Yeah, okay. So I presented C.S. Lewis's brief little trilemma, mad, bad, or God. You know, Jesus has got to be we've got to choose. It's one of those. It's not a great moral teacher. But of course, that argument itself, as Lewis well knew, is then founded upon essentially trusting the reliability of the sources, trusting the reliability of the documents that we're using. And on that point, I would suggest to you there's good reason why Lewis was trusting the documents. You know, the New Testament documents we have are fundamentally historical documents. You know, they're not first and foremost religious literature. They are historical documents. And as historical documents, they can be tested in historical ways. So we can compare them with other historical documents of the time. We can test whether they fit with what we know of the ancient world at the time. We can test the kinds of claims they make with what we can know from outside of the Bible. We can check how old they are. We can see, you know, have a good ballpark figure for when they would have originally been written and how faithfully they've been transmitted. And so the claim that the source is reliable is a solid claim. These are historical documents. And it's on the basis of that that we would then make the claim, what's very clear in the sources, is that Jesus is not just giving us moral teachings. At the heart of it all, it's not moral teachings. In fact, when it comes down to moral teachings, Jesus is not actually that revolutionary. I mean, the golden rule, you can find parallels to the golden rule of love your neighbour as yourself in all sorts of other religious teachers and all sorts of other places. But the uniqueness of the impact of Jesus is not found in the moral teachings or social reform. It's found in his claim to divinity. So, yeah, in answer to the question, the source is good. You know, the trustworthiness of the source can be shown to be credible.